applied for a search warrant, and in the search warrant, they referred to Rosen as a potential co-conspirator in violating the Espionage Act. They accused him of basically kind of being this minstrel who was trying to operate a spy ring with Stephen Kim collecting data and maybe unnamed other people collecting data. Rosen came that close to being indicted himself. When this was revealed that the government, A, called him an unindicted co-conspirator, and B, got his cell phone records, got his emails, tracked his physical movements. When this was finally revealed, and this came out in 2013, it was a huge controversy in the press because it was taken, legitimately so, as an attack on the freedom of the press.
You had James Rosen at Fox and James Risen at the New York Times.
Yes, it can get confusing at
times.
Very different stories and very different journalists, but there was something very similar in both of their cases, which is that the force of the government was brought to bear on journalists in order to connect them to crimes or get them to talk about alleged crimes.
And meanwhile, Stephen Kim continues to serve this 13 months in jail in Cumberland, Maryland.
He is in jail.
That does it for the show. Peter Maas, award-winning investigative journalist. We'll link to his piece at The Intercept called Destroyed by the Espionage Act. Stephen Kim spoke to a reporter. Now he's in jail. This is his story. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:01. Coming up next is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio with our host, Paul Rowland. Today's guest is activist and scholar Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, author of the new book, The Indigenous People's History of the United States.
Hi, this is Sun Lee, KBOO's membership coordinator. I wanted to take a moment to thank you for becoming a member. Everyone at KBOO is grateful for your generosity, and without your support, we would not be able to provide you with the great news, music, and programming that you have come to expect from KBOO. If you haven't joined our community, please consider starting a monthly deduction by going to kboo.fm/give, or you can call 503-231-8032. Thank you.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 38th Annual Portland International Film Festival, taking place now through February 21st at many locations all over Portland. This year's festival brings over 150 films from around the globe to the Portland metro area. There are strong selections of Hispanic language films, new directors, and documentaries, as well as PIFF After Dark screenings. Again, that's the 38th Annual Portland International Film Festival running through February 21st. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing and Full Circle Resale, featuring women's clothing, jewelry, and accessories with a focus on natural fibers since 1984. Gazelle and Full Circle Resale are both located at the corner of Northeast 41st and Fremont and at GazelleNaturalFiberClothing.com.
Hey, industrial streets, class lines, money talks, turning language to paper pieces, rich man's war, free man society, raging violent insecurity, nuclear man, nuclear woman, unclear how to act, rich man's war, Pershing's cruising Europe, America, Russia, governmental nuclear views, industrial allies cutting the world as though they cannot see blood flowing. Rich man's war. Central America bleeding, wounds same as Palestine and Harlem. Three Mile Island in El Salvador, Pine Ridge in Belfast. Rich man's war, the poor, starving for food, starving for land, starving for peace, starving for real. Rich man's war, attacking human, attacking being, attacking earth, attacking tomorrow. Rich man's war, thinking of always war, thinking of always war. With machines for ancestors, new unborn generations, chemical umbilical cords are only wiring. In your electrical progress, human lives burnt offerings to the god greed. With lies for ancestors, there is no truth in some futures. Rulers of minds feeding next generation souls to the control machine. Sacrifice ritual for the profit technology. With isolation for ancestors, there's only the present, bought by the credit material users. Forging chains binding you to destruction. Compliments of your deities, the industrial priest.
Yes, and good morning. This is KBOO, Portland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I am your host, Paul Roland. And that was John Trudell from the album that Bob Dylan called the best album of the year, way back when. I think when it was just a cassette, before it even made it onto CD, a.k.a. Graffiti Man and Rich Man's War. And I am here with Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. Good morning, Roxanne.
Good morning, Paul.
So you knew Trudell back in the day, I imagine, right?
Yes, I first met John, I think, in 1974. He was actually president. I think that was the title of the American Indian Movement at the time when I met him in the 70s. And then he had this tragic event in his life, you know, his family being killed, very likely by the FBI, because the day before he had burned an American flag in front of the White House. And
I thought it was on the steps of the FBI.
The steps of the FBI, yeah.
I think.
And then the next day, his wife and mother-in-law and their two children were burned alive in their house in Nevada, the reservation. So John had a tough time, and he turned to the music and kind of saved his life. And he's given so much through the music.
And that happened in the later 70s, right?
Yes, it was after Leonard Peltier was imprisoned. It was 77.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, let's give you a brief introduction. So if people haven't heard about you, I put up something on our website, and we've had actually had you on several times the past few months since your book came out, An Indigenous People's History of the United States, which is the reason why we got you up here to talk about, because you've been talking about that a lot around the country, and it's a book that's received a lot of attention. But that's not the only thing you've done. As I said in the promo for this spot, that we're going to talk about your 5 decades of activism and scholarship. I'm not sure how much of that 5 decades we're going to be able to fit in the remaining 50 minutes we have here, and with the questions that people are going to have at 503-231-8032. But maybe just give a brief sketch. I have in front of me a book, Outlaw Woman, A Memoir of the War Years, 1960 to 1975, which I've just started and is really extraordinary book of people want to get a sense of you know, that time period from a historian, you know, from the perception of a historian, a trained historian. This is a book well worth picking up. So yeah, just, you know, just sort of briefly give us a bit of a thumbnail sketch how you ended up in a place to be an outlaw woman.
Well, you know, I was raised in rural Oklahoma in a Canadian county, and various sharecropper cabins the first years of my life, first 6 years of my life. I was the youngest. The others had many more years in that such horrible, almost desperate situation. But then my father took a job driving a diesel truck to supply rural areas around western Oklahoma. And we moved into this tiny town of 100 people where my dad actually grew up. And that was Piedmont. And I went to school there. But there were all kinds of echoes of my family in that little town, because my grandfather, my dad's father, had been a militant activist in the Industrial Workers of the World, in the Socialist Party. And he named my father Moyer Haywood Scarberry Pettibone Dunbar. And those are the founders of the IWW. He was born the year that they were on trial in Boise. So I heard these stories all my life, even though my father himself was, he was not very political at all. And then he became pretty right-wing reactionary in the 60s and like George Wallace. And so it wasn't as if he was intending to transmit politics to me. He just really worshipped his father, thought he was a giant, a good man. It was so contradictory. And later I would have arguments with him. I said, you know, he was a communist and you're so anti-communist. And no, he wasn't a communist. He was a real person. And I said, well, communists are real people too. You know, it's really funny.
That's that cognitive dissonance. It's like if you have communist equivalent with, you know, whatever, non-person, you know, like evil, right? Or non-person, then you can't, someone who's a communist can't be an actual
That's
person.
That's right. But it did, you know, it was like an inoculation against anti-communism, that upbringing. And I am so grateful for it, because I think it's one of the most destructive things in society for the last 50 years. It's still going on. We're trying to make Russia communistic again. And so this was not exactly the upbringing that would make one think of the New Left and women's liberation and becoming a radical. There were not many people like me in the mainstream New Left movement that I got introduced to at San Francisco State, because I moved to California. And I went to San Francisco State and worked. And it was just, you know, 60 to 63. Things were just beginning to brew. I got involved in some housing issues of civil rights, the redlining. There were people there who became really notorious activists, the Hallinan brothers and Danny Glover as a student there. And so it was, that's again a kind of blessing, but I was kind of, really did not know how to be involved, and everyone seemed to know how, and I, you know, couldn't quite get the ropes. And there's a whole culture that it was just very hard to break into. But so I mainly was in learning mode, you know, learning from these people, because a lot of them were red diaper babies. They had been raised with very clear politics, and I had never had that offered before. Everything was kind of hodgepodge for me, you know, just getting this there. And I loved Ayn Rand, for instance. Her books were my favorite books.
Really?
Yeah, so it's not like I was just drawn to, you know, a political line that was clear. And then a lot of populism that has racism in it was appealing to me, because I didn't recognize the racism, you know, the Federal Reserve Bank kind of stuff. That's really a euphemism for Jews controlling the world. And So I had, you know, I had a very long learning curve. And then I went to graduate school at UCLA, and that's when I really began to speak out and have confidence. I did Latin American history, so I broadened, you know, my understanding to anti-imperialism, because it's right after the Cuban Revolution, so Latin American studies was in transition, and so that was also a good experience. And there is when, you know, the Vietnam War was revved up in 1964, right when I started graduate school. So those 4 years there were just, you know, absorbed in anti-war activity, civil rights, the farm workers, immigration, because it was in L.A. The Watts riots took place when I was there. So it was, you know, it became easy to be involved. You know, it became natural. But what I held very close to me was a memory of how hard it is for people who don't have a political background. I'm very sensitive to that when I'm doing organizing, that I don't call someone just stupid, you know, because they don't already know something that people have known since they were in their mother's womb, you know.
Well, it's interesting. You said it was hard to break into the kind of the activist scene, and that really struck me, because I don't know if people really realize, because we do tend to form these sort of, you know, almost for self-protection, and certainly for self-protection now that there's such incredible infiltration and disruption.
Right.
It's understandable, and it's always sort of that way, because, you know, I always thought that it's really difficult to get a sort of oppositional mindset in this culture just to begin with, even on an individual level. So if you have a sort of a group milieu, you're going to have that same kind of insularity, just because everything else seems so antagonistic and doesn't seem to get anywhere. But what you're saying, we have to guard against that.
Well, it's a tendency in U.S. history for movements, also going off into utopian communities. And it's not just, you know, the hippies of the 60s that did that. It was, you know, the Socialist Party. They went and built these communes, you know, in California, Nevada, and Louisiana, and Arkansas, after they were pretty smashed, defeated after World War I, and just became closed in. And so then they're not out organizing, or, you know, the Weather Underground that cut themselves off. They were some of the best organizers of the 60s. I say they were the best organizers of the 60s, totally then cut off from, you know, publicly organizing. So, yeah, it's a dilemma. And, of course, there is the punishment that comes with the Black Panthers. And AIM, I think, came on the scene. They said, to hell with that. We're going to be, you know, absolutely honest with everyone, because they all came from working class. We're just going to tell the truth. And, you know, COINTELPRO made them, the Black Panther Party and AIM, the number one terrorist organizations. And
yeah, they vied for number one and two.
Yeah, and knocking them off, you know, and falsely imprisoning them. And we still have political prisoners like Leonard Peltier and a number of Black Panther and Black Liberation Army prisoners. So there are costs, but I certainly am glad that I didn't feel like I was taking risks, because I didn't understand what, you know, the state could do to people. And I'm glad I didn't, because I wouldn't have been so mouthy. You know, I would have been too careful, you know. And once I was in it and angry, I always felt that being quiet was a defeat, you know, that I would that they were winning. So I think we have to approach organizing that way, for people to be fearless. Because what better life could you live in this society, in this world, than to be, it'd be better to die, you know, at 25 in that situation than to live on as a cautious person. And we really have to be fearless to really do anything. And I think I was given that as a gift, just by kind of naivete. But that's why if we organize in the working class and among the poor, that's exactly what, you know, people will be courageous, because it's life or death. And since we're all in a survival mode now with climate change, I think it's the indigenous peoples who have the best experience of surviving 500 years of genocide and colonialism, and we have a lot to learn from those struggles.
And here in the Pacific Northwest, at least the eastern tribes anyway, got put in the most difficult and dry and arid areas, so they've had to learn how to survive.
Oklahoma,
and Oklahoma, certainly Oklahoma, the eastern woodland tribes got marched all the way across to this totally foreign.
Yeah, to Kansas, Oklahoma, the Indian Territory, and here they were, from the richest farmland in the world. They were the most advanced farmers in the world in 1492. Gave the world almost all the vegetable and fruit and collagen products that we survive on today, and they built great civilizations. So then they're reduced to refugees, basically to refugees in barren places, and that's a situation a lot. Still millions of people today from U.S. action still is, it's continuing. It's still the same enemy that is creating these situations around the world. So I think it makes Indigenous Native Americans in particular really identify and be in solidarity with all oppressed peoples in the world, because they have the same oppressor, no matter who their local oppressor is. Usually outside of that, there's a role that the United States is playing, either militarily or subversive activities with the CIA and all. Well, to continue the writing, I did take a job teaching at a working class university, California State University at Hayward. It's called East Bay Campus. And they're built, I was hired in Native American Studies.
You were kind of part of the first wave of the establishment of such departments.
Yes,
right?
I was. Another gift I had is that while I was a UCLA graduate student, I was a teaching assistant, and I volunteered to be the teaching assistant for a young professor just out of UC Berkeley in history, who's Japanese Hawaiian, Ron Takaki. And Ron taught Black history, the first Black history course at UCLA. It was amazing. A lot of these activists from, this was in 66, so Watts was the year before, so these militants from South Central L.A. came, sat in on the class. I mean, UCLA was Lily White. And he welcomed them. We had huge dialogues. It was just amazing. And for the white students in that class, it was just, no experience they've ever had like that and transforming. Well, for that, he got fired or not renewed, after the first year trial. He went up to Berkeley and started the first ethnic studies department at any university in the United States. So he got me hooked on the idea. He was already plotting and planning the ideas of Native American studies. Of course, he included Asian American studies, Chicano studies, and African American studies. He had a plan in his mind, and so yes, that was one of my sort of crossover of academia and activism that I helped quite a few programs get started. I would just go, and it was an activist thing until they got established. They are very important. They've transformed departments like English and History and American Studies are almost unrecognizable compared to before. Ethnic Studies and Women's Studies also. So I immediately was, I was involved with the American Indian Movement. starting with Wounded Knee, and I kind of got recruited because I was doing my doctorate. I was also in law school. I got recruited to by the Wounded Knee Legal Defense Offense Committee to do some research on the Sioux Treaty and then be an expert witness in the trial of defendants from who, you know, 300 arrested it after Wounded Knee and put on trial. So the whole movement was around, you know, getting through all these trials, and it took years. So I got involved in that. And again, that was kind of a crossover of activism and scholarly work because they needed my credentials with a doctorate in history. And so my first published book was The Great Sioux Nation, Oral History of the Sioux Treaty, which was based on the traditional people's testimony at one of the Wounded Knee hearings that went on for 2 weeks in a federal court. And so that was an amazing first, you know, a first book that was useful. It's still useful, and still, you know, satisfied the requirements of academia. And then my dissertation had been on the history of land tenure in New Mexico, so I hadn't, you know, I was going to focus on Mexico, northern Mexico, before and after it was the borderlands, before and after it was, well, pre-colonial, and then, you know, the history of land tenure in that area. And so that was my deep knowledge. So it was, I had to learn all this, you know, about the treaties, because they're not treaty people, you know, that's not an issue for the Pueblo Indians in New Mexico. And so I, you know, I expanded out to treaties and then got involved in the international wing of the American Indian Movement. And
the International Indian Treaty Council.
Yes, the International Indian Treaty Council. And then we started a lobby at the UN, and in 1977 had a huge conference at the United Nations, non-governmental, but a lot of governments and especially liberation movements were there, and staff people in the UN that became very supportive of this effort that started really, really small. And so now in 2007, we got the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, and we have several...
A long trajectory.
Yeah, we have several, 30 years from 82 to, well, more than that, 77 to 2007. So you see this arc of something being accomplished if you stick with it and don't just flip from one thing to the other. That's one thing I learned about organizing. And not that you shouldn't do different things, but to, you know, make sure it keeps going, whatever it is you're involved in, and you're not in a position that if you leave, it's just going to disappear.
Let's put all that on hold. There's like 5 to 100 different strands I kind of want to follow up on. Probably not going to be able to do too many of them, but I'm speaking with Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, who's in town, and she's going to be speaking this afternoon at Reed College at 3, I believe in the Elliott building. And this evening...
Isn't it 2:30?
2:30, I guess.
Yeah.
And this evening at Portland State University from 6 to 9, probably get started a little more towards 6:30, at the Native American Student and Community Center, which is there kind of at the far southern end of the campus, kind of up against the freeway. Beautiful building.
Beautiful.
We're just there last evening. 710 Southwest Jackson, so that's this evening. And so you'll have a chance to meet her. And I don't think we actually ordered enough books. 10 of them just went like really quick yesterday. We didn't even have enough for the PCC students where you talked yesterday.
But get there early and grab a book.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure when we're going to do the book signing. But anyway, we're making no promises. But come in and hear her talk. And we do have a caller who's been waiting for several minutes already. So let's go to Amy and catch up with our conversation after that, or maybe she'll be part of the conversation. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi there. I went and got your book, Roxanne. I heard your interview about the book, and I went and got it, started reading it.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. It's beautiful. I love the way it opens up, and it tells of a history that we're not told. That's a big thing. That's my comment, basically, is that we're not told. We're lacking in the education. I love the way you're talking about how you came to understand things kind of slowly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I am constantly trying to figure out how come everybody goes over to the timbers, but nobody is thinking about the TPP. And, you know, there's just a small smattering of people that seem to be on point. It's because we're not educated. We're completely sent down the wrong path. And I was listening to OPB yesterday. They had a public program in Corvallis, Are We at War? And a good many people were there that had things to say that were very anti-war, which was very good. There were a couple people from the military, and they kind of go along mindlessly, like we're all in it and everything. But anyway, what I'm trying to say is we are lacking in our education. There is papers and treaties and all these kinds of agreements, like the United States just sets out papers and says we're going to do this or that. Here comes the TPP, and I'm thinking, why don't people just say, well, I don't agree with that. I didn't sign on to that.
And of course, the TPP is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, for those who aren't familiar.
Right.
Yeah. So I guess what I want to know is, you know, I was thinking, if people who rode horses and could shoot arrows didn't stop these people, how in the world am I going to do it? You know?
Well, you know, we're in the tradition of that resistance and have to carry it on. And it's a, I remember during the Vietnam War, something I learned a lot from the Vietnamese who were fighting, and was my first exposure to, just this question, how can people go on? You know, here they are, you know, mostly living in tunnels, to keep from being killed, and their beatings, the largest military in the world. Surely, if they can do this, we can find some way to beat that same military, you know, in that same guess. The Vietnamese has said this is just a tiny point in our 1,000-year struggle for liberation and freedom. And there's nothing more precious than liberation and freedom. And so we'll defeat the Americans, and then everything will be a mess, and we're going to have to, you know, it won't be over. We're going to have many more years, maybe, you know, century more of struggles. So I think Native peoples have this, inherit this, at least a few, even in the worst of times, like after 1890 to the 1930s, when there was, you know, some reversal of the decimation of numbers, where some people were able to live. And then, of course, the 50s, the big renaissance of struggle. Even in those most desperate times, it's just amazing what people were doing to still struggle. I mean, in the boarding schools, in those awful places, the kind of subversive activities, and a lot of this is being written about now, and we have to really remember that it's not, they don't always win, you know, that genocide doesn't mean wiping people out completely. Jews are still here, Armenians are still here, Cambodians are still here, Rwandans are still here, and all the Native Americans are still here and still struggling. So genocide is an intention. It's horribly destructive, and it did wipe out some whole peoples, decimated civilizations. But there's a historical memory there that is absolutely essential for the future of humanity. And that's why, it, you know, those seeds that get planted. I know the Crow at Pine Ridge, or at, among the Lakotas, the they used to hide, if they could, the real traditional people would hide their children so they didn't get taken to boarding school. They would put them in caves and, you know, take them food and do anything because, you know, the Bureau police would come and take them by force. And Leonard Crowdog, a spiritual leader in the Lakota, was one of those that got hidden and never, he didn't learn the English language until he was a teenager. And he was taught by, you know, his father, Henry Crowdog, was a medicine man. And to hear these stories, of, you know, and that's just one story. There are many, many like that and all over where the seed was planted and continued. But now we have this, you know, many, many seeds planted and the younger generation, Native people are just absolutely amazing. You know, I thought the last generation was pretty amazing, but this new bunch that I've been meeting in my travels since the book came out last September, it makes me so hopeful. You know,
I am so happy to hear that because from my point of view, I see the GMOs. And 92 was a measure here in Portland, I guess Oregon, to label the GMOs. And I just heard that the apple, this Arctic apple, the GMO apple, got approved. And it's like those trains blew up in West Virginia. I used to live in West Virginia. And I just feel like there's no stopping it. And it's just all so bad. And like all the people I talk to, anybody who can talk about this stuff, because a lot of people just say, you know what, I can't do anything about it, and it's overwhelming, and it's such a bummer, don't bring me down, and you know, all that. I don't feel in touch with the surge that, I hate to even use that word, that's terrible, but the life force, the beautiful life force of love and life. I don't see it. I just feel like we're just getting covered.
Well, you got to get out and travel some more.
Thank you.
I tell you, here in Portland, there's a lot of light. I've just, you know, just been here, just got here yesterday, and I haven't been here for a while, quite a while. Well, I don't know, you know, back when my daughter lived here in the 90s. And to me, it's a, you know, very vibrant, and the sense of, you know, love and collectivity and commitment, lifetime commitment, I think is very strong here among the indigenous peoples, among the anarchist community, and the environmentalists. And it's just that we really have to hammer some things out, figure a lot of things out. And it's not like I have them all figured out myself. But with this book, I just thought we needed to have a better framework and perspective, you know, for how we go about things.
Well, listen, thank you very much for calling, Amy. I'd like to give other people
a
chance. It's already 8:37, and you are listening to KBOO. This is Wednesday Talk Radio with your host, Paul Rowland, one of five different hosts, the different weekday mornings between 8 and 9 here on KBOO, and I'm speaking with Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, who's in town for a few days, and she'll be again, and Amy, and anybody else who's wants to get a more of that spirit of engagement and enthusiasm, come to PSU this evening, 6 to 9 p.m. at the Native Center, and meet some like-minded folks. And we do have a couple more callers. I know we really wanted to get into the subject you really got into deeply at the end of your question and answer session at PCC. We may or may not have time, but again, people will be able to come hear more about that, which is basically where we're at right now in this whole continuity of this really insane, violent culture that it's really, as Amy said, it's really hard to come to grips with. It just seems so inexorable. And obviously, as you're saying, Native people have seen that, have been, felt the full brunt of that, and survived and continue. And but we do have a couple more callers, so let's hear what they have to say. John, you're on the air.
Hello. I'm just going to take this conversation a little bit different. I was raised not really raised, but exposed to Native Americans in my youth or whatever. But that's another story. That's when you're young and you don't really notice much. But when I was in my mid-20s, I was watching Oregon Public Broadcasting, and they had a round table of Native Americans, and they were talking about their issues and all this kind of stuff. And so they were talking about the Alcatraz occupation, stuff like that, et cetera. But they were also talking about how their forefathers, you know, some of their quotes they made in the past, how they came true. Sort of like how, you know, like Roman, Greek, or even some European, you know, philosophers. And, it, you know, wow, it really astonished people. But they said that, you know, there was something that really kind of grasped their conscience when I don't know who was the speaker for the, you know, ancient Indians, you know, with Black Elk or whatever. But they said that the plight of their people would improve when the eagle lands on the moon.
Mm.
And I was kind of thrown back because, you know, that was when, you know, 1969 July, you know, there was the eagle has landed. So after that, you know, they said things would improve for them. This is what, but this was said by a chief way back, I think it was right after the ghost dance.
Mm-hmm.
And so they couldn't relate to it until, wow, you know, like almost 90 years later.
Okay, well, let's see what Roxanne has to say about that.
Yeah, there are a lot of prophecies. There's some really extraordinary, you know, around the world, there are some extraordinary people who have a ultra-sensory, you know, perception that most of us mundane people do not have. And these were very sacred people in Native nations, you know, who were listened to. They were often people who, in our society, would be outcasts, at least, you know, in the past, and, well, still in many places, they would be gay or maybe even celibate, you know, not even interested in sexuality, very much in the mind, or they would be albino, or blind or disabled in some way. And it was thought, you know, it was understood that anyone in that kind of situation, or say a very old person, had a special perception that the majority people did not have. And they relied on their, I mean, they could be today considered mentally ill, some of them, you know, maybe. Schizophrenia has probably always existed. It's a chemical imbalance in humanity. But instead of locking them up somewhere or giving them drugs, they listened to them, you know, and they could thrive in the community because they had an important role. So I think...
And they had a support network.
Yes.
Which
and
is highly lacking in the right. world today.
And in general, women, in usually elderly women, but women in general... were acknowledged to have very special the Sundance, you know, is males are supposed to go through the pain of birth, that ripping of the flesh off the chest after the labor of dancing for 3 days. That's a birth process. That's supposed to humble a person as childbirth does. The woman is humbled, and that's a positive thing, to be humbled by pain and experience. And so women are revered for also for insights of that sort. And I think that so the prophecies are, you know, have to be taken seriously. I know Thomas Banyaka was the carrier of the Hopi prophecy. He's passed away now, but he lived a very long life, I think almost to 100. And so we had access to Thomas all during the 60s and 70s and into the 80s. And he had, the Hopi prophecy famously is, you know, some drawings in a cave long, long pre-colonial times that show a path of humanity from birth of humanity to the present, and So he inherited where, you know, where that line was. It's sort of like the Mayan, you know, the Mayan prophecies. And he said, you know, there's these this road that humanity was on. There was a split at some point, and they interpret that to be the onset of colonialism. You know, the greed, the separation of the beginning of crushing whole civilizations. And there were parts of that, you know, that were already happening. But for that to be then the totally dominant, you know, conquering the whole Western Hemisphere and the Pacific and all the people who were practicing democracy and community, that it's a strayed path. It's instead of looking at what's happened as progress, we look at it's actually going backwards. You know, we have to get back to the thinking of that time, which a lot of people have stored memories of, has been handed down, and get back to that point and go on a different track. But there's doom at the end of the other one, that if it's not reversed, if there's not, you know, going back and returning to the source, as Amilcar Cabral put it, then there's the destruction of humanity and all of life. So this was actually in the 60s before there was a much consciousness of environmentalism. And then, of course, the first Earth Day was in 1970. And then the first UN conference on the environment was 1972 in Stockholm. And Thomas Banyaka was there and warning people. He spoke at the UN General Assembly, warning people for years and years, it has to be not just stopped, but, you know, reversed, you know, just really almost starting over. So listen, that's a very, yeah, the prophecies are very important, I think.
I just want to thank you, John, for calling.
Okay, thank you.
And I just noticed we have a couple more callers, and I kind of very always ambivalent about this role as a talk show host, because I have to interrupt people. I just want to keep hearing them talk. But I also look and see we have more callers, and we have to respect them too, because they've been waiting so patiently. Sunny, you're on the air.
Yes. Oh, how nice to talk with you. What a fine mind you have, and you really are, you know, you are from the history clan.
Thank you.
What a beauty. What a beauty thing. It's wonderful, wonderful. And it's such an important word for everyone to hear, because there's so much good, important information for minds of all colors, because there are so many good ideas within our history and examples of surviving and ingenuity and, well, you know, good things, like there are good things amongst all people. And I wanted to say something really quickly to that fine-hearted young woman who called in with so much understandable concern about so much that faces their generation particularly. And these young people, you know, their hearts have already got to be weary somewhat, but they're not, because the Creator has made them strong. And I would recommend to her that where she goes to school and such, that she set up a little table where people can come and sit together and share lunch and soup and get to know one another. And first thing, start that circle of comfort and support to one another, because many within her age group, older and younger too, are looking for it, particularly at this time. And I want her to find it. And she's got a lovely, lovely, bright heart. And the other thing I was going to say, if you have opportunity to speak somewhere about parts of history that might not be true at all, that are put down to us as truth, that is so valuable. And of course, that's what you do. An example might be Little Big Man. I have a feeling that Little Big Man did not betray Crazy Horse, but what a good way to destroy him.
Mm-hmm.
There's a thought. Who knows? But I will hang up now. But I think there are probable many, there, I'm sure there are many other instances where we just have we have so much lies told to us. And then the last thing is, we're Oklahoma Indians, many work across many nations, but also we're IWW, International Workers of the World Indians also.
Oh, good.
So you're the only other one I've met so far.
Oh, wow.
I grew up in rural Oregon, so I didn't meet very many old wobbly families at all anyway. So anyway, but thank you, and I'll get off the air.
Thank you for calling, Sunny.
Thank you, Sunny. Yeah, well, thanks for those comments. And for responding to Amy, too.
So let's go to our next caller. David, you're on the air.
Hi, good. Thank you for taking my call, and it's great having the show. I've always been a proponent of Native American rights. I'm not Native American, but I'm Asian. I grew up in Portland. And, you know, we look same-same, and so the discrimination is same-same. My mom, she got a teaching degree at Oregon State, but she couldn't get a job in Oregon because she was Asian. And so, you know, I live out in the gorge where the, you know, where a lot of the river people were, and you see a lot of the tribal fishers still out there. But, you know, the thing I see is it's discrimination against Native Americans, but I see the whole Euro colonialism, there's in general discrimination against Asians. I mean, you look at the Native Americans are Asians. You look at what we're doing in Korea, what we did in Vietnam, and you hear, and there's this huge wave swell of anti-Chinese crest everywhere, and it's unfounded, but it still comes back to this basic, this racial discrimination and fear of Asians. And it's been going on for 500 years, and they're really beating the drums to go into China. And I think once we get past that, our Native Americans cultures are going to be seen more across the landscape, but it won't happen until this ingrained social discrimination against Asians in general in this country, everywhere you look. You know, we have to be in Japan, we have to be in Korea, we did in Vietnam. And so I just applaud the Native Americans for being here today, despite all the discrimination. And if we look closely, we can see their signs and footprints and their wisdom. And shows like this, we just slowly have to erode this ingrained anti-Asian.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I mean, here's like 60-70% of humanity. I mean, if you count India, Asian people, and this is, you know, the future is clearly not going to be Europe. And and I think this fear of the loss of dominance, and that's why the whole Western European powers are behind the United States, because the United States is now the point man for imperialism and control all of the non-European peoples of the world. but yeah, that insidious, and I even see it on, you know, on the left and among anarchist friends, just taking from the mainstream news headlines all kinds of China bashing and agreeing with it, you know. When the Olympics happened, the Chinese Olympics in San Francisco, the torch came through there. This is such a large Chinese community, and there were actually demonstrations against it, against China. And it's like, you know, these are people who would probably never even come out to an anti-war demonstration or, you know, Native Rights or Ferguson or something. And you know, I think they also include Russia as Asiatics too. And so you have that bashing going on, and it's just really disheartening, and it's one of the things we must not leave out, you know, must include in all of our so I really thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah, well, thank you. And I just, you know, this, the awareness of Native Americans is endured all these years, but, you know, we're still at a tipping point, and every day I see Native Americans out in the gorge, and we're still at a tipping point, and this it just keeps on coming, and we just got to stand up and let people hear it and make awareness.
All right. Well, thank you very much for calling.
Thank you.
And we only have about 6 minutes left, and time flies so rapidly on talk radio. Wish we had two or three hours. Yeah. And people are, as I mentioned, and I'll mention again, she'll be speaking a couple more times today in Portland at Reed College at 2:30 at Elliott Hall, I believe. I'm sure you'll be able to find it if you make your way over there. And at 6:30 tonight at the PSU, Portland State University Native American Student and Community Center, which, as I said, is at the far southern end, kind of right off of Broadway just before you get to the freeway there. And come on out. And hopefully there'll be enough books for people who want them. If not, we're going to actually try to order some more. And I do want to mention that, you know, KBOO is a co-sponsor of your tour here, as well as a PSU Students for Unity, the PSU Indigenous Nations Studies Program, Eradicating Offensive Native Masketry, which is a Jackie Keeler's group who we got a chance to hang out with yesterday evening. And she'll be there and hopefully sharing some words with us this evening at PSU. Also, the HELA 503 Collective, Institute for Anarchist Studies, Portland Central America Solidarity Committee, Portland Rising Tide, Rethinking Schools of Portland, Oregon Jericho and the Civil Liberties Defense Center, as well as, this is an older program, the PSU Palestinian group that's actually going to have an amazing program of talk next week on Tuesday about indigeneity in Palestine, which is going to be just amazing. Dr. Michael Yellowbird is going to be there along with Omar, and I can't remember his last name. And I'm going to have some of them on this Friday briefly and on my talk radio show next week. And there, I've taken up another 2 minutes. And gosh, we have more callers. We're going to just squeeze one more call in and get Roxanne to give us some last words. Mike, you're on the air.
Oh, good morning. Thanks for your show. Thanks for the guest. It's wonderful. I don't have time to ask my main question about her understanding of history of the empire in America here, dividing and conquering by creating civil war within the Native American communities. We don't hear about that, and it's always been on my mind. But so I won't ask that, but I do want to comment. I hope that you get a chance to visit and get involved with NAYA, which is a Native youth organization here in Portland. Thank you very much. Bye.
Well, thank you. And in the book, An Indigenous People's History of the United States, I deal a lot with the practices of colonialism. It's not just Native Americans. It's because I did a lot of work with liberation movements, the African National Congress and Southwest African People's Organization back in the, you know, the 60s and 70s, and the Sahrawi movement of the Western Sahara, and many others. this is how colonialism works. It's their MO. So it's inevitable. And I think the destructive thing is when we think it's unique to our own people, that somehow we just can't get along. And when this is instrumental, and all you have to do is go back to a very recent events of COINTELPRO, and there are many books on, you know, how COINTELPRO, the counterinsurgency program of the FBI in the 1950s and 60s and 70s, and how it divided movements and even brought to some, you know, violence, killings of each other, of civil war within the Black Panther Party, the American Indian Movement, the Puerto Rican, the Young Lords, and the Chicano movement. So this is to be expected. So we just have to build that into our internal education, that this is going to happen, and some people will fall for it, but let's keep the momentum up and not, you know, not be destroyed by it.
Well, and I want to just sort of apologize to the Native American Youth and Family Association. I had meant to involve them in this tour, and anyway, it's one of those things that a total breach of protocol on my part. So I just want to offer that for whatever it might be worth. And maybe if you do come back to town again, we'll be able to set up something with them as well. We have about a minute left, which isn't, of course, enough time to make any grand summation remarks. But why would you encourage people to come out and hear you talk and meet other like-minded people this evening?
Well, I think, you know, what I want to talk about this evening is what existed in the Western Hemisphere, and then, you know, focus in on what is now claimed by the United States of America continentally, on what existed, what was destroyed, what was lost, and what threads can be regained and rebuilt upon.
Well, thank you so much, Roxanne.
Thank you.
Too short, as always. I hope we get a chance to sit down and have a longer talk at some point. And again, she'll be speaking tonight at Portland State University at 6:30 p.m. Be there for extended period, so you'll get a chance to ask questions, make comments, interact with her, and meet other people, and get some movement going. Let's bring back the spirit of the 60s,
yes,
or...
Spirit of Crazy Horse.
Spirit of Crazy Horse. Okay, going out with John Trudell. Thank you so much, Roxanne.
Thank you.
Industrial allies cutting the world as though they cannot see blood flowing. Rich man's war. Central America bleeding, wounds same as Palestine and Harlem. Three Mile Island in El Salvador, Pine Ridge in Belfast. Rich man's war. The poor, starving for food, starving for land, starving for peace, starving for real. Rich man's war. Attacking human, attacking being, attacking earth, attacking tomorrow. Rich man's war. Thinking of always war. Thinking of always war.
The myth of an exceptional U.S.-American people destined to bring order out of chaos, to stimulate economic growth, and to replace savagery with civilization, not just in North America but throughout the world, proved to have enormous staying power.
KABU is co-sponsoring three talks by Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, a longtime indigenous rights activist, scholar, renowned feminist, and author of the new book, An Indigenous People's History of the United States. Wednesday, February 18th, she will be speaking at PSU's Native American Student and Community Center.